This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Tan Sri Dr. Munir Majid's long and distinguished career includes being group editor of the New Straits Times, executive chairman of CIMB, founding executive chairman of the Malaysian Securities Commission and chairman of Malaysia Airlines. He's currently chairman of Bank Mualamat Malaysia and writes regularly for The Star, focusing mainly on contemporary economic and political issues. Dr. Munir, who's also visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics, will be in Kuala Lumpur April 3rd next year for the 6th London School of Economics Asia Forum to chair a session titled International and Regional Relations in Asia. Welcome to the show. Dr. Munir, you've been a banker, journalist, airline executive, and now an academic. Can you run us through your career trajectory and what led you from one industry to the other?
Oh, I see. I mean, I've been away in England for a long time before I came back to Malaysia in the end of 1978. And I thought the best way to catch up on Malaysia was to go into journalism, and you know. But I thought it was going to be a kind of a springboard to get to know people quickly, and move on to what I was doing a bit in England.
It does tend to be banking. Journalism, yeah.
So, but then I got stuck into journalism, got interested in it, and so on, and stayed longer than I intended. Then I went back to investment banking. We had some successes there, CIMB. We were very small, called PBS before. I changed the name to CIMB and so on. And we had a very big mandate. We did some new issuance of securities in a new fashion, in a new way. In 92, I think it was, or 91. And then I was invited by the government to start the Malaysian Securities Commission. I was there until 99. Since then, I've been more or less non-executive positions since 2000. You know, been in telecoms director, been mass director, chairman, and now, you know, Bank Mualamat, which is an Islamic financial institution, which is my main corporate office in Malaysia now. But I spent some time in London as visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics at a center called IDEAS. You know, Center for International Affairs, Diplomacy, and Strategy. And it is here I do a bit of teaching, I do some research. I started the Southeast Asia International Affairs Program at LSE IDEAS, and I was its head until the last academic year because, you know, I don't have that kind of time to continue, and I'm not a full-time faculty member of the London School of Economics. I'm a visiting senior fellow. So I hear it's going to develop. What I started from being a program is possibly might develop into a center for Southeast Asia.
Right.
Which is a great thing to see happen.
And when you look back, you know, on your career amidst, you know, all these different companies, what do you think has been sort of a guiding principle? Because a lot of these positions are in, you know, vastly different fields, you know, journalism and investment banking, while they have some bedfellows, you know, they're not exactly cousins.
That's right. I think the most important thing is people, dealing with people, linking up with people, getting people fired up, and then, you know, going for certain objectives. The second thing, I think, is a mix of people, a mix of age, a mix of gender, a mix of race, creates a dynamic situation and proper reward and equal treatment of people again. And I've been lucky, you know, New Straits Times had some good people in those days and you know, very fired up people, idealistic people. And then a CIMB, you know, we built it up from being a very small merchant bank to being the second largest by the time I left. And of course, most important of all, I think in my career that I'm perhaps proudest of is starting the Securities Commission and seeing people who had started and helped me start the Securities Commission now in positions of authority and power themselves, like Dato' Ranjit Singh, for example. He was in almost at the start. Dr. Nick Ramla is almost in at the start. Then, you know, many, you know, it's people, I think, who are committed and who are fired up and, you know, who are led in a fair fashion.
And we've talked quite a bit, you know, you've mentioned, and I've mentioned actually, quite a lot of the different positions that you've held, including what you're currently involved in. So what's a day in the life at the moment? What takes up the majority of your time?
Nowadays with the internet and so on, I mean, you seem to be not off the internet, you know, it's something you get up, you want to check, you know, before you sleep, you know, you check or you write, you read. But I do read a lot still, not just digital reading, you know, normal new books.
Hard copies, yeah.
Hard copy stuff. And you know, I write a fair bit and building up a lot of writing over time. I published a book, which is a collection of essays. The title, which I suppose might antagonize some people, but they should read the book. It's called 9/11 and the Attack on Muslims. And, you know, it seems like an ironic thing that it should be the case, but I covered the period after 9/11 and what happened in terms of American foreign policy and how, you know, some innocents were really killed. They happened to be Muslims, you know, and so, I mean, so I want to write about a couple more books before I'm done. So I read, I write, and then, of course, in terms of Bank of Wamala, it takes up, in terms of time, about 50% of my time, I think. LSE takes up maybe about 25 to 30% of my time. And I give a lot of lectures abroad, you know, in Beijing or in Dubai, you know. I get linked up with various institutions, including LSE-based, you know, relationships, and do give lectures. LSE, I'm involved in a program as a teacher, a lecturer, which is an MSc executive program, MSc in strategy and diplomacy. Pretty busy.
It's a full plate. And I'd like to find out more about that book shortly. But before that, let's focus on the ASEAN region and how Malaysia fits in there. Recent revelations by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden implicated Singapore in helping the United States spy on Malaysia. How do you see this affecting Malaysia's relations with the US and with Singapore?
I don't think. I mean, we've had problems before, even with Singapore. In terms of alleged spying, we never know. We just read about these things. I mean, unless you are in government, you know. So I think there was a case when S.R. Nathan was High Commissioner Singapore here, and he left in a bit of a hurry. I think, I'm not mistaken, it was in 1985, you know. Because Dr. Mahathir is very firm about these things. He was already in power, of course, Mahathir then, and SR, who I actually know because he was... My uncle was his boss in the Singapore Foreign Office.
Small world.
Yeah. and SR became president. So, but relations were repaired. The thing about this WikiLeaks thing is that it shows how rampant and widespread it is to become almost common. So, you know, when it is almost common, then everybody does it.
It's almost expected.
It's a question of whether you're better at it or not, or you're more conscious of security when you go on that mobile. You see Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, for example, getting angry with the Australians, very deeply angry. I think a lot of the anger is not because of the exposure of state secrets or security matters to a country which is, after all, a friend, you know. It is more the fact that you actually eavesdrop on my every conversation, and not every conversation that is had by a president even is all about state affairs, you know. It could be about very personal matters too, you know. And I think that's a kind of anger people feel.
That invasion of privacy.
Yeah, invasion, exactly.
Of course, one thing that WikiLeaks and all this whistleblowing has really brought into the public eye is that idea of, that distinction between freedom of information and national security. In your opinion, where does that line stand? And is it sort of a big black line in the middle of the road, or is it more of a grey area?
I think it's obviously, you know, grey, but it's also obviously getting greyer, you know, because the intrusion of technology into what was sacred, you know, personal security, personal sort of matters, the intrusion is greater than we all know or think. Everything you sent on the SMS, for example, is stored, you know, by the provider, service provider, you know, and of course it's destroyed after a while, but if there's need to get access to it, you know, they can get access to it. And then when you do bank transactions, you know, it is accessible. Even if you do conventional bank transactions, reports of extraordinary or out of the ordinary sort of payments or receipts, go to Bank Negara. You know, compliance officers send it and they get it and they can see, you know, who's moving money about where and how much, you know.
So in this day and age where this sort of surveillance, as you point out, is perhaps almost commonplace, almost expected, you know, is WikiLeaks then doing a public service? Should diplomatic cables just be made public since it seems almost everybody knows everything about everyone anyway?
Oh, I don't think it's doing a public service. It itself is being intrusive into that system of that web, you know, of information tapping, you know. So it itself is playing that game. And so I don't think it's above it all. It is superior to the game being played. So I wouldn't say, you know, it's, you know, doing any kind of particular public service. It's interesting. You know, it's gossipy and people get...
It is. But is this level of openness a good thing for diplomacy? I mean, I guess the word diplomatic in and of itself has become almost synonymous with this, with the idea of beating around the bush on something, you know, or not being straightforward. So having all this information out in the open, is it necessarily a good thing in your view?
Some information is good to have in the open. I mean, especially, you know, transactions. You want to have transparency in terms of, you know, normal transactions, contracts involving government or private sector. It should be, you know, if they're open, they'll be above board, you know, it'll be less likelihood of corruption and less costly to the taxpayer, you know, in terms of contracts finally decided upon. Therefore, it's a good thing. But there are also areas in which it may be a bad thing in terms of diplomacy, security, national security, real national security, not manufactured ones, you know, to just stop people from asking questions, but real national security. If you want to fix something with the Chinese prime minister or president and you have a conversation with him with respect to, for example, how far into Malaysian territorial waters you can move in respect of your claims of South China Sea, and therefore you have an understanding that those movements will not invite any kind of panic reaction or what have you. You don't want people to know these things, do you? I mean, and people know it because you have different arrangements with the Chinese from other people who might therefore feel aggrieved, you know, that the Chinese do not accord them the same sort of relationship or treatment. And you want to preserve that special relationship. And you do not want it to be undermined by unnecessary exposure of what you talk to them about.
I'm speaking today to Tan Sri Dr. Munir Majid, Visiting Senior Fellow at the London School of Economics, and we're discussing Malaysia in a global economy. Coming up, we look at how the West might react or should react to the rise of China and whether there's room for two superpowers in the world. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. All right, second half, ready? Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Tan Sri Dr. Munir Majid, Visiting Senior Fellow at the London School of Economics, and we're talking about Malaysia in a global economy. So, you know, let's look at Asia. Obviously, the rise of China has been an incredibly hot topic. Everybody's been talking about it. How should the West react to this, and to a larger extent, the shift of power towards the East? Is there room for two superpowers in the world?
Well, there was room for two superpowers before, wasn't there, when there was the Soviet Union and the United States.
But they were at loggerheads. But they were at loggerheads.
Yes. And therefore, it's better that you could have two superpowers not at loggerheads. It can still happen. It can be accommodated. Although by no means I would think of China as a superpower already. You know, I would call it a great power. The U.S. is a sole superpower now. Of course, China could become the second superpower. Therefore, the U.S. might act in ways to stop it becoming a superpower or to accommodate it becoming, you know, a superpower. And China is essentially a great power right now, an Asian power. So the kinds of things we see happening between the U.S. and China in terms of their relationship is primarily a contest for influence in Asia. And of course, you know, China doesn't mean China's not in Africa or it's not in Latin America, but the primary contest for influence in Asia. And here you see China predominant in the economy in terms of trade. You know, ASEAN's largest trading partner is China. The largest, fastest growth in trade between ASEAN and any other region is with China. ASEAN is China's third largest trading partner after the U.S. and the EU. I mean, which is a significant, sort of slice of activity between the two. Although in terms of investment, China is by far still behind the U.S., which is, for example, Malaysia's largest investment partner. Malaysia has invested in China, and China's talking about new investments in the future. It's talking about the development of infrastructure. The next phase in Asia's development is going to be in infrastructure and in urbanization. So infrastructure, you'll be building, you know, transport infrastructure, you'll be building sort of telecommunications infrastructure. There's a lot of money, and infrastructure needs are huge, you know, in Asia. And China has got resources, financial resources, you know, to finance it. Of course, it'll want Chinese contractors to get the job and so on. But that's quite normal. That's how people go about it. And China has come up with a slew of proposals in October about a greater, closer relationship with ASEAN. It has also actually, you know, proposed the formation of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which will be the largest in population terms economic bloc in the world. It will be third largest in the world in terms of GDP, you know, in terms of trade volume, if it happens. So economically, you know, China is strong in Asia and well-founded. The U.S. has got weak in terms of its economy because of the the crisis and what have you. At the same time, you know, it has actually been preoccupied in the Middle East, preoccupied in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that godforsaken war of theirs for no rhyme or reason. It's the country's in a worse state now than when before the Americans went in March 2003. And so you have this situation where the Americans have been absent.
And there's been a vacuum of sorts.
And now they're trying to come back.
Right.
And obviously there's going to be some friction, you know, when they try to come back. And they're not very elegant, usually, when they try to come back. They're only elegant with words. But, when they push too hard, China feels threatened, you know. So there is a bit of friction between the two. But it's not by no means reach a point of conflict as between two superpowers, or as you suggested just now, between the Soviet Union and the
United States.
The United States.
With that being said, I mean, we've talked about how, I guess, in the ASEAN region, China is obviously the predominant power at the moment. So how should Malaysia then position itself in the face of these two giants?
Oh, we should be, you know, I mean, we should be friends with everyone who wants to be friends with us. And we're not a great power ourselves. Yet we are a dynamic, growing economic country. We are the third largest economy in ASEAN. And ASEAN is our base for growth. And ASEAN is a $2 trillion U.S. dollar economy. And it's growing probably 5% or so, and it is going to be a center of production if the ASEAN economic community takes root, and is supposed to take root, of course, from December 2015, in the year that Malaysia is going to be chairman of ASEAN. Be good, but I don't think it'll be 100% ASEAN economic community. But people are talking about forming production bases, you know, in ASEAN. American companies want to do it. Japanese companies want to do it. And American companies also want to do it. And we don't say, oh, yes to the Chinese, no, you know, to the Americans and Japanese. We say yes to the best, you know, who offers us, you know, the best terms, whether it's automotive industry, you know, that they're going to expand.
Electronics
and base in here. So we are, I mean, equidistance is a word people use in international relations to describe this kind of thing, but you're never, ever, always equidistant. It moves around, it bobs about, you know, but you are friends with the both of them. But in terms of potential, China has got something like, I don't know, 400, 450 million tourists coming out into the world. Now, you want that kind of demand to drive your tourism industry, for example. China will import by the next five years something like $10 trillion worth of imports. Now, you want to see what can you sell? You want to drill down and see what are the sectors in which you can benefit.
Of course.
So the numbers are big. You know, the potential is great for China.
And you mentioned earlier how China is, you know, a great power, not yet a superpower. So what can Asia learn from the West in terms of economic growth? You know, what are the lessons that we can pluck?
Now, the West was an open economy. It was an economy that encouraged competition and the triumph of the best. This creates dynamism, which drives growth, and it is something we should try to aim for. On the other hand, they also were very bad in terms of, you know, welfare. I mean, state principles, dependency on the state, payment of the dole, 35-hour week, you know, pensions at 60 or 58, you know, when their population is aging, a system of government which is generally very good, but can also be dysfunctional, as we have seen in the States recently.
Mm.
So, you know, it's all not all good, not all bad. So we will, you know, we should take the best. China is always criticized as a model, you know, it's a centralized system, there's no personal freedom, they even impose a one-child policy on you and, you know, intrude into your social life, and there are labor camps, there's no rule of law, you know, you name it. Yes, but China's improved tremendously, you know, from 1978. It's a huge country of 1.2, 1.3 billion people. And, it, you know, to change that country, to turn that ship, it's not an easy thing, you know. But China has turned it. And the third plenum that took place last weekend, shows that Xi Jinping might turn out to be a reformer. Difficult to match Deng Xiaoping, but a reformer of some repute for China.
So there are lessons to be taken on both sides, I think, is, you know, the takeaway from that. Yeah. Now, back to your book. As you mentioned, it's rather controversially titled 9/11 and the Attack on Muslims. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about the Middle East, or was it kind of triggered by 9/11 as so many other things were?
It was triggered by 9/11, you know, and as a Muslim myself, you know, I mean, I felt ashamed, appalled at what happened, and how could do things. The genius of hate, I called it, the way they did it. Then I got appalled at the American reaction to this. I mean, because of those geezers who, you know, did them in such an appalling fashion, and they felt, they felt small that they could fall, you know, to that kind of
ploy,
attack.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they bombed Afghanistan back to the Stone Age, you know, I mean, to rubble over God knows how many weeks. And then, of course, as if that wasn't enough, they tried to link Al-Qaeda with Iraq, which is totally untrue. There's no linkage of any sort. But they were just trying to finish some other business against Saddam Hussein. I actually interviewed Saddam Hussein, you know, in 1981 when I was working for the NST.
What was that like?
Oh, he's a strange fella.
Yeah. I think that's putting it mildly.
Yeah. He, you know, you can ask him a question, like, you know, if you ask me a question, he doesn't answer the question, he just makes a speech. Okay? So you ask your follow-up question, he continues with his speech, you know, disregarding you. So it wasn't an interview, it was a monologue, you know, sort of thing.
And of course, you know, in I guess issues within the Middle East continue to be unresolved, you know, on many, many fronts. Are you optimistic of the Iran nuclear deal coming through?
Oh, gosh, the Economist magazine had this week's something about the man who could walk on water. That was Obama, and now he can't. I think Obama makes too many speeches and uses too many words and gives rise to too many expectations, as a result of which, you know, he can fall short, especially when people in his own country are undermining him all the time. So it's not easy for him to operate. It's, you know, I mean, Netanyahu sort of tried to bully the president of the United States with the help of the Congress of the United States, you know. So, you know, so now he wants to do this deal with Iran, which they have done, which is, I think they say, is an interim deal. In other words, you slow down on your nuclear program, and we will also sort of ease up on our sanctions. So it is like watch it as it goes, kind of thing. And I think that's what the deal is all about. If there was some report of the Iranians enriching uranium beyond the point that has been agreed, I think then, of course, sanctions can be, you know, tightened up again. At the end of the matter, it is not just a nuclear matter. Iran is a middle power. It's a major power in the Middle East. But people are suspicious of what it would do with or without nuclear weapons. And the most suspicious are not just Israel, but the conservative Arab states. And so they, you know, they feel threatened by Iran, but that threat Obama cannot remove. The fact of Iran's existence and its expression of its power in the region has to be something states in the region have to contend with and relate to, like we have with China or we have with Indonesia. We can't say, okay, make sure Indonesia doesn't grow bigger than it is now, you know, in terms of military. No, you have to relate and do it. It's not a responsibility of some outside power to do it. If you say it's their responsibility, then they'll come in and then they'll have alliances and so on and so forth. And they were different types. There'll be different types of complications.
Another conflict in the Middle East that's grabbing headlines is, of course, in Syria. You know, do you have a view on how the civil conflict in Syria could possibly be resolved?
My God, you ask me sort of questions which, you know, great statesmen of the world have not been able to resolve. And, you know, Bashar Assad, you know, was a different man when he was in the UK training to be a dentist, you know, a bit of a playboy, I think, as well, and so on. And once you get power, it can get to your head. You won't give it up. You don't give it up because you have too much to lose. You would have more to lose and much more to lose. You've done a lot of bad. Then they'll have not just too much to lose, you've got probably your life to lose, you know? And so it gets from bad to worse. And so who will want to give up power in that kind of situation? So you can try to understand, although not, you know, approve, you know, how people can think like that. And therefore, he has been going on and on and on. And those fighting him are not united by any means.
No.
And they also use whatever they can, you know, to make their point. So it's becoming a very messy situation. How do you solve it? I mean, if you just got rid of Bashar, do you think there will be peace there in Syria? I'm not supporting him at all. But, you know, thinking ahead, you know, what is the way?
With, you know, the example of Egypt as well, where you overthrow somebody and then after which there still isn't exactly peace, you know, there still isn't exactly what you would call an abiding system. Yeah, I suppose. It's very similar in that sense.
When society is divided, you know, that shows how unstable it can be. You know, that's you're spot on in mentioning Egypt. And Syria is also quite divided society, you know.
Moving closer to home, you know, and hopefully with questions that are less sort of involving, you know, elder statesmen and so on. The theme of next year's LSE Asia Forum is integration, welfare and growth. How has Malaysia performed on all three?
How is Malaysia's performance on what?
All three fronts of integration, welfare and growth.
Integration, welfare and growth. Okay. I think the theme was a nation, look at the Asian team, and whether Malaysia is doing well on integration or not, you have asked me, I think we can do a hell of a lot better. I think we can do a hell of a lot better if we actually look at the positives, you know, that keep us together, and look at the negatives that are pulling us apart and calm them down. You know, the negatives. Now, some of the negatives are the use of religion. I'm talking about using of Islam, you know, to undermine that integration effort, you know, both ideologically as well as socially. You know, you don't mix with people and so on and so forth. You know, you cannot be near a plate which has had pork in it. And it's unnecessary, you know, totally unnecessary. So you don't use that. And then racism, you know. You cannot be racial about things. We're all Malaysians. And, I mean, in as much as, you know, I, as a Malay, can say, okay, you go back to China, you useless fella, man. You could say, hey, you go to Indonesia, right? You know, so where do you begin? You know, where do you begin? So this race thing, we should drop that. That stupid racist base approach, you know, this is not your country, you go away, you go, that is wrong. And so I think we have to I think, you know, draw the line about what we shouldn't be doing on the negative side. You know, on the positive side, you know, we remind ourselves about what we were like before, what we were like when I grew up in Penang, you know, when I went to school at RMC in Sungai Besi. My friends of all types, and even when I came back to work, you know, here at the NST, at the SC, we all, you know, very fantastic bunch of people who achieved fantastic things, and we were mixed, you know, we were mixed people, and we didn't turn our backs. Malaysia can be fantastic if we were truly united and integrated. Alas, because of problems, I always say we are suboptimal. You know, we are not at full throttle, but our suboptimality, however, is better than some other states' optimality. So that you know, so that makes us a little complacent. You know, so in terms of welfare, you know, in terms of welfare, we are, you know, we are providing many things now that we never provided before. And poverty, eradication of poverty, has been a positive success. Whatever you say of the government and so on, of the country. And in terms of provision of hospital services, we are not too bad, you know. We're not too bad for the poor, that is, you know. I mean, pensioners get free medical service, and the government actually pays it through privatized agencies which do it in various places, in Sabah and so on. Of course, in terms of growth, that is our great, you know, our great story and our growth in the 80s, you know, and the 90s. I mean, the 90s particularly, until the 97, 98 financial crisis was, you know, 9.79%. So we were the little tigers, you know, after the first tigers had done their job of growth. But of course, when this crisis came, that put us back for 2 or 3 years, and we've been struggling, you know, to move forward, but we've been moving forward nonetheless. Growth rates of 5-6%, not that, you know, 8-9% of yesteryear, and we're moving forward. And now we are in a middle income country. People talk about being in a middle income trap. What should we do? Human capital development and so on. And that's where treatment of people, again, how they're treated, how they integrate with each other, how they feel about working in Malaysia, staying in Malaysia, contributing to Malaysia, have their children grow in Malaysia, see Malaysia grow, will come in. And I think that's when, you know, all those other policies about integration and, you know, welfare matter for the future.
You know, back to your mention of Islam, how would you reconcile the moderate image Prime Minister Najib put forth into the world stage with the proliferation of ethno-nationalist rhetoric within the country?
Yeah, ethno-nationalist, ethno-religious rhetoric is quite widespread. in the world, you know, and we talked just now about the world, the digital economy and internet. You know what's happening in Burma and how Muslims in Rohingyas and also other Muslims who've been Burmese citizens have been attacked and so on. You hear about this, you see it happen, and then you get angry. I get angry. But just imagine, if I was persuaded through my anger to go and attack a Buddhist temple or whatever. I mean, which has happened, for example, in Indonesia. A guy had a plan to do so, to bomb the, I think, Burmese embassy or whatever, Myanmar embassy. So people are exposed to what's happening, and they respond and they react. And those sorts of reactions are part of human nature, if you like. Now, therefore, there is rice in ethno-religious, ethno-nationalistic sentiments all over the world, But Muslims must make sure that they are not seen as a violent type, violent kind. Why are Muslims attacking mosques, attacking churches in Makassar, in Sulawesi? Why? Because what? The Christians are richer? Because they get all the best jobs. So there are these kinds of animosities, of jealousies, that take place, and hence you have these events that take place. In Malaysia, we are now exposed to all this kind of knowledge. We have to manage our society in a way that it does not go out of hand. And as I said, to do so, our politicians have to say certain things are out, mate. You don't, bring those issues. And look at the good things that we're able to achieve, when we are together.
I guess it's a matter of redrawing the focus and kind of redefining the conversation. And my final question to you would be, so, we've talked about the global economy. We've talked about, how Malaysia should interact with it. Where would you currently place our country in the global economy? Where are we? We used to be the little tigers. Now, in 2013, where are we headed?
I know we are known and we are recognized. I think one of the reasons why the LSE Asia Forum, is being held in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur on the 3rd of April, is because we are one of the top cities and countries in Asia. I mean, this forum had been held before, in Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Beijing, India. So we had Manmohan Singh coming and opening this sort of thing. So it is in itself a recognition of this country. Why do they want to have it here? Could have it in some other country, Jakarta. So let's not say Jakarta or whatever, But Malaysia is significant, it is important, it is recognized, and it is part of growing Asia. And growing Asia is the dynamic world, of tomorrow. I think we've got it all going for us. We have to address certain challenges to that future that are evident, and we cannot close our eyes to them or turn our backs on them. So we got it all going for us, and internationally we are recognized, as having grown so much over so many years in a stable environment, and so we must make our future, not destroy it.
Thank you, Dr. Munir. I've been speaking to Tan Sri Dr. Munir Majid, Visiting Senior Fellow at the London School of Economics. We've been discussing Malaysia in a global economy, among many other things, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.